From WYPR, I'm Sheila Kast. We're on the record. The growing wealth gap between rich and poor is creating a parallel gap in hopes and aspirations. University of Maryland public policy professor Carol Graham says in the past, Americans have tolerated more inequality than citizens of other countries.
In this country, we've always seen inequality as sort of a sign of where I might go. It's a sign of opportunity. If I work hard, I can be Bill Gates.
In her new book, Happiness for All, Graham traces how that's changing. For more Americans who are poor, success seems so unattainable, they've lost hope. They see little point in investing in the future, and their children get the message. An exception, many poor blacks have more faith in the American dream. It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at WYPR.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@WYPR.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Kast. We're On the Record. It's right there in the fourth line of the Declaration of Independence, in the brief enumeration of the human rights that cannot be taken from us, the one we'll talk about today, the pursuit of happiness. It's the one that underpins our sense of the land of opportunity and the American dream. As much as we worry about inequality of wealth and income, have we looked at whether people in America have an equal opportunity to pursue happiness? Carol Graham has looked intensely at that question and developed new ways of analyzing it. She's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and professor in the University of Maryland School of Public Policy. One of her specialties is measuring well-being, which is more nuanced than you might think. In her newest book, she connects insights about well-being with research about economic inequality. The book's title starts with a question, Happiness for All? Unequal Hopes and Lives in Pursuit of the American Dream. And Carol Graham joins us on the line from Brookings. Welcome to On the Record.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Happiness doesn't sound at first like a very serious topic for an economist. Anyone who picks up your book will see a lot of graphs and charts and complicated equations, so it's pretty obviously serious. But how did you get into studying happiness?
Indeed. In the dismal science, when I was one of the very small number of economists collaborating with psychologists in the early, part of the decade around the year 2000, trying to understand the non-income determinants of well-being and understand some puzzles, a lot of progress paradoxes. For example, I was doing work in Peru and other poor countries around the world and finding that people who were making progress out of poverty were more frustrated with their lives and less happy, broadly defined, than people who weren't making progress at all. And, trying to understand this, I fell into a very small group of economists and psychologists collaborating with each other to understand human well-being, and happiness is the colloquial term that gets lots of attention. And indeed, initially, we were considered to be certified crazy. The change since then has been amazing, and it's become a mainstream tool in a lot of economic analysis. Not everything, but it's very much used by academic economists, their governments around the world. And, it just took, I think, a lot of time. People had to get used to moving away from only using income-based measures of progress and thinking of what we could learn from surveys of people's well-being.
Well, how do you measure it? How do you measure well-being?
Well, first of all is to get the definitions right. The most important thing to remember when you think about this is we aren't running around interviewing people and saying what makes you happy, because you'd always get data that was just not comparable and biased. And what we do is we have surveys of literally hundreds of thousands, millions of people around the world. And so we have people answer two kinds of questions. One is how they evaluate their lives as a whole. So how satisfied are they with their lives as a whole, which captures their opportunities, how they think of their past, how they think of their future. Those questions correlate much more closely with people's income because people who have more means are able to choose the kind of lives they want to lead. It doesn't mean more and more income makes people, you know, happier and happier, but it does mean that income does matter. But then we also measure people's daily experience. So how frequently did you smile yesterday? How were you stressed frequently yesterday? Were you angry frequently? Were you happy yesterday? Which is just a contentment measure. And then we can, we have those metrics, and then we also take data on people's age, their income, their gender, their employment status, their marital status, their religious affiliation or not, a whole range of things. Do they live in the city? Do they live in the country? Their health status, and then controlling for those demographic and economic factors, we look at how well-being varies depending on do they smoke or not, do they exercise or not, are they employed or not, do they participate in volunteering or not, do people who commute more rather than less hours experience more anger on a daily basis. There's a whole range of questions that we can then ask, but the trick is to get the method right and to make sure that we're separating when we take their well-being metrics, their measures of life satisfaction, anger, stress, happiness, smiling, from the questions we're asking. So we aren't saying, does commuting make you angry? They don't even know we're asking them, that we're looking at how much they commute. We just have that in the data about them. But we do know how they're well-being, their happiness, their sadness, their anger, their stress varies. So it sounds a little complicated, but it is important to get it right because it's not a sort of an approach about telling people how to be happy. It's really trying to understand the determinants of human well-being.
In Happiness for All, you focus on inequality and in particular the signal that inequality sends. What do you mean by the signal?
So if you think about the American dream, the land of opportunity, the Horatio Alger myth in the United States, it's all about everybody who works hard can get ahead. And we have this conception of ourselves as a unique country that's a meritocracy. And for some years, we had exceptional levels of social and economic mobility in this country, but that is very much no longer the case. So what I've been looking at is trying to understand if inequality of income also is associated with inequality of well-being, of hope for the future, of being able to lead the kind of life one wants to lead. And the answer to that is a definitive yes. And the reason is that I would say even up to a decade ago, most Americans saw inequality as a sign of where they could go. While in other cultures, people seem to be more bothered by inequality, more willing to tax, more willing to build better safety nets in the spirit of helping those who fall behind, in this country, we've always seen inequality as sort of a sign of where I might go. It's a sign of opportunity. If I work hard, I can be Bill Gates. Over the past decade, probably longer, first of all, our levels of inequality have gone to some of the highest levels of most countries in the world. But we're also seeing that the links between, for example, parents' education and income and children's educational outcomes are very, very strong. Wage gaps across blacks and whites still remain large. Where you start on the ladder seems to play much more of a determining role than it used to, and that we think it does. And so if you are on the end of the ladder where all of a sudden inequality doesn't signal where you can go, then it becomes a negative channel to well-being and it makes people unhappy, frustrated, stressed, worried.
That's Carol Graham here on The Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. She's a professor at the University of Maryland School of Public Policy who studies well-being and how to measure it. We're talking about her new book, Happiness for All. She'll be speaking about it tomorrow evening at the Johns Hopkins Barnes & Noble at 33rd and St. Paul Streets. So you write about the correlation between inequality and rising mortality rates, including suicides and opioid overdoses among rural whites in the U.S. How does that fit into the picture?
Well, one of the things that surprised me with this whole enterprise, and indeed – you know, I've done a lot of work on developing countries, but coming back to the U.S., I kept being struck by the desperate nature of poverty, the sort of depressingness, the lack of hope among the poor compared to hopefulness among the poor in Latin America. And I set out to explore the role of our high levels of inequality in that story and ended up an equally important story about race and place. And so what I found that surprised me was that despite historical discrimination, despite historical challenges, that poor blacks in particular were so much more optimistic than poor whites. Poor Hispanics are also more optimistic. I expected that. I'm from Latin America. Latin Americans score always above what their incomes would predict in terms of how optimistic and happy they are. And I found this in around the middle of 2015 when we had riots in Ferguson, like we're having riots now in St. Louis, riots in Baltimore. And I expected some desperation in the African-American community. Instead, on average, I got these incredibly high levels of optimism, less stress, more resilience among poor blacks and poor whites, and started to try and understand that story. And I think there are two explanations. One is higher levels of resilience among minorities, blacks and Hispanics, I think due to just a history of having to cope, having to adapt, having to adjust to challenges. People do that, whether it's churches or families or whatever it might be. There's very strong informal safety nets that matter. Also just things we can't explain, just more resilience, less likelihood of committing suicide or getting reporting depression. On the side of the poor whites, and the opioids and the suicide rates. You know, we were all surprised in around the middle of 2015 when Anne Case Nangis-Deaton released this first study of premature deaths among poor whites and the U.S. mortality rate being driven up by premature deaths among middle-aged blue-collar whites, the only wealthy country in the world where our mortality rate is going up and not down. And if you look at trends for blacks and Hispanics, their mortality rates are continuing to go down. So this was very much a blue-collar white story. And in trying to understand that and contrast it with the resilience among minorities, you have to look at economic trends like the hollowing out of manufacturing, but you also have to look at other factors which economists are less used to looking at. Loss of, you know, to the extent that minorities have these built-in informal safety nets, blue-collar whites typically had their workplace and their stable families. You know, they eschewed safety nets. Typically, they don't support government programs for the poor. But when you get this double whammy of the hollowing out of the manufacturing sector, but also huge declines in marriage stability and other things among poor whites, there isn't a history of having everything thrown upside down. And so we find that the desperation, anger, hopelessness, and premature suicide is the highest among blue-collar white males, but it's also very evident among uneducated white women. Again, not only in rural areas, but definitely concentrated in the heartland and then also Appalachia, where we've seen just a hollowing out of employment, but also a hollowing out of communities. You know, it's a very depressing context to live in. Throw in an oversupply of opioids among people who are vulnerable to desperation, and you have a perfect and very ugly storm.
Reading your book, and maybe I'm overestimating how much I understood before I started reading it. Maybe now it seems obvious in a way. I'm nodding along as I'm reading you. Tell us that people who don't have hope in the future, not likely to invest in it for themselves or their children, so they don't take the measures that will make their lives better in the future, and then their lives aren't better. That almost seems self-evident. What is the insight that people should take from your book?
Right. Well, I mean, it seems self-evident, but when I wrote the first article on this in 2004, it was called Does Happiness Pay? Showing with overtime data on people that people who were happier in period one and more importantly had hopes for their future and their future mobility did better later in life. They were healthier. They did better in the labor market. They earned more money. They even did better on the social front. Again, this is when economics thought this was a little nuts. It's interesting that article wasn't cited much when I first wrote it, and it's cited all the time today now that there's been a change, much more openness to behavioral economics and thinking about issues like hope and mindsets and everything else. But so it seems self-evident, but to show it is a bit of a trick, you know, because you have to isolate people's environment from their character traits and then see, you know, follow them over time and see what happens later. But other people have done this with everything from twins to other experimental studies. I've done a lot of work among poor populations, again, looking at do people with more hope for the future, you know, in period one, in the early period, do better? Do they resist negative shocks better? Do they invest more in their education? And indeed, we find that there's sort of an innate resilience, innate hope matters a lot to people's outcome. But there's also some of it that has to do with the environment that you grow up in. The difference between the amount of negative words that a poor child hears in this country and the amount of positive world that a rich child hears is huge. And that, you know, that creates a whole different mindset. If, you know, somebody's telling you, you can do well in the future, try, invest in it, versus everything stinks, the system stacked against us, the, you know, you're doomed to failure. And so we find indeed that that this hope or lack of hope among downwardly mobile, basically blue-collar whites, is absolutely robustly associated with premature mortality. So it's kind of the ultimate lack of hope, right? It's yeah. not just that you aren't going anywhere in the future; you're going backwards. You're losing your, you know, your meaning in life. And so that's a really desperate story. The more positive side of the story is that there's a lot in the well-being literature and work that shows that there are other things that really matter to people's mindsets and their hope and their resilience, which can be take place at the community level. Volunteering, for example, people who volunteer are much happier and more hopeful than people who don't, because that gives them a purpose in life, and it gives them interactions with other people.
Let's pick that up when we come back. We need to take a quick break on the record. And when we're back with Professor Carol Graham, author of Happiness for All, we'll talk about how measuring happiness in an organized way could provide an early warning system. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking today about happiness, in particular the connection between happiness and economic inequality, with Professor Carol Graham of the University of Maryland School of Public Policy. Her new book is titled Happiness for All: Unequal Hopes and Lives in Pursuit of the American Dream. It explains how inequality in income and wealth leads to inequality in dreams and aspirations. Professor Graham, in your view, did the financial crisis of 2008 trigger the picture we're seeing now?
I think some of the picture we're seeing now started well before. If you look at when manufacturing started to hollow out, technology-driven growth, that's a much longer-term structural trend. If you look at erosion in our public education system and lack of good technical education, that started earlier. But the financial crisis was the hammer in the coffin, basically. It was a financial crisis that very much hit the working population very hard. It was exacerbated by the bubble in the housing market and people who had taken on mortgages that they couldn't afford and certainly couldn't afford once they lost their jobs. The recovery, which was important, was also uneven. So the same places that are hurting in terms of lack of employment, social isolation, had less options. People talk about now is, you know, that our moving rates are lower than they were before. People are less likely to move to another place to look for a job. But if you're in rural Kansas and you're foreclosed on your house and you have a high school education and you used to work in a car factory, you know, you're 55, you're not going to move to Silicon Valley and get a job. So the unevenness in the recovery, again, hit the same group of people very hard. Now, it also hit African Americans. as much as it hit poor whites, it hit Hispanics as much as it hit poor whites. But I guess it was this combination of factors that was more prevalent among poor whites, and also I think less experience with negative shocks, that created a extra sort of hit.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Carol Graham, author of Happiness for All, Unequal Hopes and Lives in Pursuit of the American Dream. The Financial Times described it as hillbilly elegy for econometricians. You are an advocate of governments actually measuring well-being and using the data to shape policy. Where is that being done?
I'm a little careful about this because I'm very against sort of there are these ideas of replacing gross national product with gross national happiness and making happiness an objective of government policy. And I think that's very misguided and open to manipulation and mismeasurement. But yes, I'm very much in favor of and have been involved in efforts to include these kinds of metrics into our statistical surveys. I was on a National Academies panel for the U.S., where there have been some surveys, like the American Time Use surveys and some of the health surveys, that now incorporate some well-being metrics. But the British government jumped full in, and they have been including four measures of well-being in their national statistical survey every year since the year 2011, and using them to measure all kinds of things. The data or the well-being metrics are really good for, I'd say, three dimensions of policy. One is just informing policy design. So you have cost-benefit analysis on the one hand, but you also, from these metrics, can get a sense of how particular policies might affect people. An example from the Brits, there was a proposal to close all rural post offices. From cost-benefit analysis, makes sense. They're remote. They don't deliver much mail. The mail could get to these people some other way if you just looked at, you know, a balance sheet. Turned out from their well-being metrics, the visit to the rural post office was the most important time of the day for most isolated rural respondents, particularly the elderly, right? So it was giving them a social connection, a purpose, what to do, you know, in that day. And so that informed, you know, well, maybe we'll reconsider just the income side of this closing the post office's story. So that's the kind of sort of insight. Then there's also, you can use the metric to see how a policy works, not just in income terms, but is it creating stress or is it, you know, improving life satisfaction? And then you can monitor changes over time as a particular intervention unfolds. And the thing I think that you're picking up on from reading the book that I've been talking about is if we had been monitoring well-being regularly, as the Brits are, and it wasn't just me in my office picking up desperation among poor whites, we might have captured the desperation and high levels of stress and anger in these cohorts much earlier before we waited for our suicide rates to go up to sound the alarms. I mean, that just seems to be a tragic way to go.
The overall impact of the book, I would have to say, is sobering, some would say depressing, about the outlook for the American dream. Do you see an answer? Do you think we can save the American dream?
Right. And the last chapter tentatively says yes. And it is probably the saddest book I've ever written. Although one of the things that in part comes from my work on well-being and looking at community interventions that make a difference, but also looking at bottom-up programs that seem to work even today in this very divided political context where so much is uncertain, and is that there are community-level things that make a huge difference. I talked about volunteering, but there are also stories, for example, Huntington, West Virginia was one of the poorest county in the United States, decline of coal mining, all these drugs, same stories. Through some combination of municipal government, private investment, community involvement, they came up with a community revitalization scheme, which including investing in public works, giving people some jobs. It included big investments in public education. And they've started to really turn this place around. And that was a bottom-up effort. The city of Santa Monica implemented a well-being index, and I was an advisor to that effort. They used it as a way to highlight division in their community and what might be some of the things that would help. So there's a lot going on in terms of bottom-up efforts, I think, that make a difference. There is much more to be done, and I think we can't just dismiss the essential role of public efforts like bettering the public education system. The next generation of kids in these hollowed-out places needs to be better educated so that if they want to move to where jobs are, they can. And that's going to require big public investments in better public education, job training, technical training, all sorts of things. Obviously, our health policy is going to matter a lot, what we do about opioids. Certainly, taking insurance away is not this, you know, it's hardly a forward-looking solution. You know, we have a lot to think about from a public policy responsibility level.
You have given us a lot to think about in this book. Congratulations on it.
Oh, thank you very much. Thanks for reading it.
Carol Graham, professor at the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland and senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, is the author of Happiness for All, Unequal Hopes and Lives in Pursuit of the American Dream. She'll be speaking about it tomorrow evening, 7 p.m. at the Johns Hopkins Barnes & Noble at 33rd and St. Paul Streets. More information at the On the Record page at WIPR.org. I'm Sheila Cass. Glad you've been with us this morning. Hope you'll come back tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.